Blog Talk Radio.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
Representative Jamie Raskin testifies about why we need a memorial to Thomas Paine.
Then we speak with Yale sociology professor Philip S. Gorski,
author of The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy.
All that and more following the latest headlines provided by the United Nations Radio and Democracy Now!
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The situation at Ukraine's Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant could lead to disaster, the UN Secretary General said on Thursday, directly appealing for all military activities there to end immediately. The past several days have seen reports of further deeply worrying incidents that could, if they continue, lead to disaster, Antonio Guterres said. His comments came ahead of an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council in response to the Zaporizhzhia crisis, which Russia and Ukraine deny targeting. Mr. Guterres urged the withdrawal of all military personnel and equipment and any further deployment of forces there. The UN chief also called for an urgent agreement at a technical level to fix a safe perimeter around the plant. The number of young people globally who can't find work this year is set to reach 73 million. That's a full 6 million more than before COVID-19, the UN Labour Agency said on Thursday. According to the International Labour Organization, ILO, the pandemic has caused much higher unemployment losses for 15 to 24-year-olds in securing work than older workers. Here's Martha Newton, ILO Deputy Director General for Policy.
We know that the COVID-19 pandemic has wreaked havoc on youth labor markets throughout the world, and it's exposed a number of shortcomings in the way the needs of young people are addressed, especially the most vulnerable first-time job seekers, school dropouts, fresh graduates with little experience, and those who are remaining inactive, not by choice.
The UN Labour Agency report found that young women have struggled more than their male counterparts to find work during the pandemic. The UN's top human rights official, Michelle Bachelet, spoke out on Thursday at the high number of Palestinians, children included, who've been killed and injured in clashes with Israeli soldiers this year. Her comments followed violence involving Israeli forces and Palestinian armed groups in Gaza last weekend that left 17 children dead. And on Tuesday, two more youngsters were killed during Israeli law enforcement operations in the West Bank, bringing the total Palestinian death toll this year to 37. Inflicting hurt on any child during the course of conflict is deeply disturbing, and the killing and maiming of so many children this year is unconscionable, Ms. Bachelet said, adding that an almost total lack of accountability persists in the occupied Palestinian territory. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights condemned Israeli strikes that had hit apparently civilian objects, issuing a reminder that such attacks are prohibited under international law. Ms. Bachelet also said that Palestinian armed groups had launched hundreds of rockets and mortars at Israeli targets that had injured 70 people, according to the authorities. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Attorney General Merrick Garland asked a federal judge to unseal the warrant the FBI used in its August 8th search of former President Donald Trump's estate in Florida. Garland announced the request Thursday as he delivered his first public comment since Trump said the FBI had searched his Mar-a-Lago residence Monday.
The department filed a motion to make public the warrant and receipt in light of the former president's public confirmation of the search, the surrounding circumstances, and the substantial public interest in this matter.
Attorney General Garland said he personally approved the warrant and condemned verbal attacks on the FBI and Justice Department by Trump and his allies. The Washington Post reports the FBI is seeking, among other things, highly classified documents about U.S. nuclear weapons. Hours after Garland's remarks, Donald Trump said in a statement he encouraged the immediate unsealing of the warrant. If Trump is proven to have mishandled classified documents, he could be guilty of a felony. In 2018, then-President Trump signed a bill upgrading the crime from a misdemeanor to a felony while increasing punishments for those who mishandle classified information. In Ohio, a man wearing body armor and armed with an AR-15-style assault rifle fired a nail gun into an FBI field office in Cincinnati Thursday, prompting a gun battle, chase, and armed standoff that ended hours later when the gunman was shot dead by police in a cornfield. Officials identified the man as 42-year-old Ricky Schiffer, a supporter of Donald Trump and the far-right Proud Boys. 2 days before Thursday's attack on the FBI, Schiffer posted on Trump's Truth Social online forum, calling on allies to, quote, kill the FBI on sight, unquote. Schiffer also appears in a video posted to Facebook on January 5, 2021, showing him at a pro-Trump rally in Washington, D.C. the night before the assault on the Capitol, and he boasted online he was at the insurrection. The FBI's execution of a search warrant on Mar-a-Lago last week has spawned extremely violent rhetoric among Trump supporters. The pro-Trump Gateway Pundit website declared, "This means war," a message echoed by Trump's former top political advisor, Steve Bannon, who declared, "The FBI is the Gestapo," unquote. Today is the fifth anniversary of the deadly 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, where a self-described neo-Nazi slammed his car into a crowd of anti-racist counter-protesters, killing Heather Heyer and injuring dozens of others. A federal court in Washington, D.C. has sentenced a former police officer, Thomas Robertson, to more than 7 years in prison over his role in the January 6 assault on the U.S. Capitol. Robertson had served as a police officer in Rocky Mount, Virginia. A month prior to the insurrection, Robertson called for an open armed rebellion. Another former Rocky Mountain police officer, Jacob Fracker, is being sentenced today. Meanwhile, newly revealed documents show officials of the Department of Homeland Security tried to warn Congress last April that text messages sent by Secret Service agents around the time of the January 6th insurrection were missing. But their attempts were thwarted by the DHS Inspector General Joseph Kafari, a Donald Trump appointee. The revelation prompted renewed calls for Kafari to resign. President Biden has not ruled out firing him. The Centers for Disease Control has further relaxed its guidelines on COVID-19. The CDC's new recommendations further shift the onus to individuals rather than public health measures to reduce the risks of catching the disease. The CDC no longer recommends people remain at least 6 feet apart, no longer recommends quarantine for people who've been exposed to an infected person. On Thursday, a CDC epidemiologist told reporters, quote, "We know that COVID-19 is here to stay," unquote. More than 40,000 people are currently hospitalized with COVID-19 across the United States, where the disease continues to kill more than 3,300 people each week. The International Atomic Energy Agency is calling on Russia and Ukraine to immediately halt fighting around Europe's largest nuclear power plant. On Thursday, Ukraine reported at least 10 Russian shells exploded near the sprawling Zaporizhia nuclear complex, the latest in a series of attacks that have threatened to trigger a nuclear catastrophe. In Kyiv, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Thursday Russia had taken the whole world hostage.
Russia has again hit the bottom in the world history of terrorism. No one else has used a nuclear power plant so obviously to threaten the whole world and to put forward some conditions.
Earlier today, Russia's ambassador to the United Nations said he does not support international calls for a demilitarized zone around the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. Elsewhere in Ukraine, residents of Kharkiv continue to come under heavy shelling, with people reporting missiles striking a crowded neighborhood Thursday.
There are no military vehicles here. It's the center of Kharkiv. People live here. It's usually very quiet, with no military objects nearby. I have no idea why our yard was shelled.
Meanwhile, Russia's foreign ministry has acknowledged for the first time it's negotiating with the Biden administration for a prisoner swap that could see jailed U.S. citizens Brittany Griner and Paul Whelan freed from Russian penal colonies. President Biden said the news left him hopeful a prisoner swap could soon be completed. The Pentagon says it carried out three airstrikes in Somalia Tuesday that killed four al-Shabaab fighters. It was the second time in recent weeks that U.S. Central Command announced airstrikes in Somalia. Elsewhere, five people were killed and 100 others injured Thursday as Somali government forces clashed with demonstrators in towns across the breakaway region of Somaliland. Witnesses said security forces used clubs and live fire to attack protesters who were calling on the Somali leader, Muse Bihi Abdi, not to delay presidential elections in November. This comes as the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees said it recently registered the 1 millionth person displaced by Somalia's devastating drought, which has led to widespread crop failure and the death of livestock since January 2021. The UN says the number of Somalis facing hunger is expected to rise to more than 7 million in the coming months due to the effects of the climate crisis and rising food prices caused by the Russian war on Ukraine. In southwestern France, more than 10,000 people have been forced to evacuate a massive wildfire that continues to burn out of control near the city of Bordeaux. Firefighters from Austria, Greece, Germany, Poland, and Romania have joined some 10,000 French firefighters battling the blaze. This comes as much of Europe continues to bake in an unprecedented heat wave. Meanwhile, wildfires are raging in central Portugal, and parts of the United Kingdom are again under an extreme heat warning. In Brazil, thousands of people took to the streets of cities across the country Thursday in defense of democracy after far-right President Jair Bolsonaro threatened to reject the results of October's first-round presidential election if he loses. Former leftist Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who is running again, currently leads in the polls. Bolsonaro has been claiming without evidence Brazil's electronic voting system is vulnerable. This is a protester in Rio de Janeiro.
We are here to ask for free elections, free education, and improvements for our people, because our people cannot be dying of hunger.
In more news from Brazil, police have arrested another five people linked to the June murders of British journalist Dom Phillips and Brazilian indigenous rights advocate Bruno Pereira. Authorities also identified one of the suspects in the murder as the leader of an illegal fishing organized crime group in the Amazon region. Phillips and Pereira went missing in Brazil's Javari Valley in June. Their remains were found dismembered about 2 weeks later. You can go to democracynow.org to see our interview with indigenous lawyer Eliesio Maruba in Brasilia about calls to independently investigate their murders. And the San Francisco Chronicle reports at least seven employees with the San Francisco District Attorney's Office have resigned since Brooke Jenkins was appointed DA in July. She replaced former progressive DA Chesa Boudin, who was ousted by voters in June in a multi-million-dollar funded special recall election led by the real estate industry. 15 other staff members were fired following the recall election. Jenkins said she volunteered in Boudin's recall efforts, but it has now been revealed that she received over $100,000 as a consultant for a nonprofit called Neighbors for a Better San Francisco, linked to efforts targeting Boudin, who aimed to reform the criminal justice system but faced mounting attacks by the real estate industry. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. See
Welcome to Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. All religions are inconsistent with mental freedom. That's a quote by the great agnostic orator Robert Greene Ingersoll, whose anniversary of his birth is today, August 11th. He was born 1833. I think he might amend that to say all religions except perhaps the creedless religion of Unitarianism or Universalism.
Or maybe the religion of coffee or so.
Yes.
However you use the word religion, yeah. Well, so I'm Dan Barker. It's how happy 190th birthday, Robert Greene Ingersoll, although...
The most famous agnostic and freethinker of the 19th century.
Of course, he didn't believe in life after death, so he can't hear me say happy birthday. But anyway, happy birthday, Robert Greene Ingersoll. Annie Laurie and I are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and this is the August 11th, 2022 edition of Free Thought Radio. Grant Blaschka is our engineer. He's with the recording studio Audio for the Arts. He's engineering right here in our building in the Stephen Yule Friendly Atheist Studio in Free Thought Hall. This building is the national office of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin.
And we recently learned that this great benefactor and his wife, Diane, who also recently died, pronounced their name Uhl. It's spelled U-H-L. So
did I say it wrong?
Yeah, because we've said it wrong for years. We only learned posthumously that we were doing that.
Stephen Uhl, friend
but
of the atheist.
But we are so grateful to him and Diane for all their help. The Freedom From Religion Foundation produces Free Thought Radio. It's our weekly radio show that kind of synthesizes the news of the week and also makes commentary on the news of the week. And we have two purposes: to keep religion out of government and social policy, never more needed, and to represent the views of people who are personally free from religion. So we have over 38,000 members, and we'd love to have you join us today at ffrf.org.
The music you're going to hear between segments today is by a band called The Earthlings, and our engineer, Grant Blaschka, is... Grant, you're the bassist in the group, is that right?
Yeah, that is correct.
Yeah, and I understand you guys have a new album that you just had a release party for... What's the new album called?
The album is titled Terra Obscura, and yeah, we just released it at the High Noon Saloon last weekend on August 6th, so you
yeah.
can find it on Spotify and YouTube and all those good places now.
We played a little bit of it before, but we're really glad to be using this music again in our outros, so congratulations.
Yeah, thanks so much for letting me play some tunes.
That's The Earthlings is the group. I guess these UFOs are coming to the Earth saying, "We want to meet the Earthlings." Well, there you go. We got one right here in our studio. A few weeks ago on this show, we spoke with Samuel L. Perry. He's co-author of the book, The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy. Today, on the second half of our show, we're going to speak with the other co-author of that book, Philip S. Gorski, about the religious threat to American democracy.
But for the rest, the first two segments of the show, we are going to devote them to Thomas Paine and the great legislative efforts going on to memorialize him in Washington, D.C., the very new developments. Paine is America's forgotten founder. And there was testimony on July 27th before the National Capitol Memorial Advisory Committee, known as NCMAC, in D.C. It was remote testimony, and a very important testimony to get their endorsement for the resolution that has been introduced by Representative Jamie Raskin to have a memorial to Paine in D.C. And so it was a wonderful testimony, so we thought that we would play it.
FFRF's Director of Governmental Affairs, Mark Dan, who helped set up this whole thing, he introduced the various speakers in favor of this new proposed memorial to Thomas Paine. The first person to testify was the esteemed member of Congress, Representative Jamie Raskin.
H.R. 6720 to authorize the Thomas Paine Memorial Association to establish commemorative work in honor of Thomas Paine in the District of Columbia and its environs and for other purposes. Congressman Raskin, we have already introduced you for your to provide testimony, so thank you very much.
Thank you so much for taking me and for your flexibility. You've got my written testimony, so I don't want to, you know, bore everybody to tears by reading it. But I do want to say that America would not exist without Tom Paine. And it certainly would not exist as the world's first great constitutional democracy. You know, before Paine and the revolution, everything was kings and queens and emirs and czars and emperors and you name it. And it was Paine's writings that came to define the meaning of America. And his vision was so much more comprehensive and sweeping, even than the most radical founders like Jefferson and Ben Franklin, that all of them attributed the success of the revolution to Tom Paine. Because even Franklin and Jefferson were at the beginning, before Paine got there, just talking about vindicating the rights of Englishmen under the Magna Carta. And Paine said, we have the opportunity to create a completely new country. I mean, he got here in 1774, 2 years before the revolution, and he fell in love with the promise of America. He said that America would become a haven of refuge, an asylum to mankind, not an insane asylum, mind you, but a place of refuge for people fleeing from political and religious and economic oppression from all over the world. And he said, and once we created government on the principle of democracy and self-government, then the cause of America would become the cause of mankind. So we not only ourselves would incarnate and instantiate the principles of democratic self-government, but we would become a model and then an aid to people all over the world who themselves were trying to throw off the yoke of oppression. So Paine wrote in 1776, Common Sense. It became America's first bestseller. It swept the country. There were more than 500,000 copies that were in print then. We tried to figure out what that would mean today. It's something like 60 million copies. I mean, everybody was talking about Common Sense, because what he was talking about was creating government on a completely different principle, on the basis of freedom and rights. And of course, in the Declaration of Independence, that becomes the unalienable rights of the people, on the principle of equality among everyone. And that becomes the statement in the Declaration, that all men are created equal. And then the idea of democracy itself, or the consent of the governed, as Jefferson would come to put it. And Jefferson, of course, comes to credit Paine for a lot of his ideas. But he wasn't just an ivory tower intellectual, Tom Paine. He was a rabble-rouser and an organizer of Americans against the crown and for the revolution. He had many stirring statements, "The times have found us." And then in 1776, when the revolution began, he wrote this beautiful pamphlet called The Crisis. This is the one that George Washington read to the troops at Valley Forge and in other places, and he had readings of it to the revolutionary troops wherever they were. But in it, he said this, I'll update the language a teeny bit at the instruction of Speaker Pelosi, just because she's, you know, she claims correctly that Paine was a feminist, an early feminist who argued for the equal rights of women. But he wrote in this passage, these are the times that try men and women's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will shrink at this moment from the service of their cause and their country. But everyone that stands with us now will win the love and the favor and the affection of every man and every woman for all time. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered, but we have this saving consolation. The more difficult the struggle, the more glorious in the end will be our victory. And those words were read to Revolutionary War troops in tattered uniforms, sleeping in dirty blankets in the mud. And, you know, Washington talked about the electrifying effect that it had on people. And, you know, he had lots of other writings that were so beautiful. My favorite is really his answer to Edmund Burke on the rights of man, when Burke was, you know, attacking the French Revolution. Paine was a controversial figure because his passion for democracy was so overwhelming. And for that reason, he has been overlooked and he's been pushed to the side. But I think that Americans across the political spectrum can invoke him and fight to him and try to live up to his model. There were people on January 6th outside who were talking about Tom Paine. There were people on the inside talking about Tom Paine, and to the extent that all of us are trying to articulate the values of democratic self-government, he will always be a sterling example to us. Napoleon said that there should be statues erected to Tom Paine all over the world, because he was really the first great champion of democracy. So, look, you guys know all of your standards better than I do. I looked at them quickly, and it seemed to me that Tom Paine meets all of your standards with flying colors in terms of being a figure of imperishable historical importance and significance. And it seemed to me you had kind of two different rankings. I would obviously argue for the bullseye center. I think that Paine is exactly the kind of person that we need to honor, that we should honor, and especially in this century where democracy is under siege all over the world, what better time could there be to honor him? So thank you for checking out this petition. And I've got a bunch of members of Congress on my side. Because I've been busy with other stuff, I haven't spent a lot of time organizing, but I'm sure I can get more if that's something that you think you need, because there are people who cite Tom Paine all the time on the floor who aren't even yet on my list. And I'm happy to take any questions.
So Representative Jamie Raskin, so informed, such an advocate for Thomas Paine, such an appropriate person to sponsor this legislation. Very moving testimony. And then we heard from Margaret Downey, who is the president of the Thomas Paine Memorial Association, shepherding this bill through.
The Thomas Paine Memorial Association was founded in late 2021 as a 501c3 educational nonprofit organization designed to uphold and promote the legacy of Thomas Paine. Now, a similar project was approved in joint resolution in 1994. It was signed into law by President Clinton. The project was abandoned due only to a lack of funding, and this is why we are proud to announce that there will not be such a barrier with the current project. No government money or taxpayer dollars will be needed for the current proposed Thomas Paine Memorial. Now, some of Thomas Paine's key accomplishments include the writing of Common Sense, which outlined the compelling reasons for independence from England. He wrote the inspiring words found in the American Crisis that motivated Revolutionary War soldiers to continue fighting against all odds. And his quill served George Washington much better than a musket. His literary battlefield work made Thomas Paine one of America's very first veterans. Thomas Paine's book, Rights of Man, called for citizen representation over monarchy, public education, relief for the poor, and old age pensions. Thomas Paine was steadfastly in objection to slavery, and he publicly acknowledged his admiration of Native Americans. For these accomplishments, high morals, outstanding ethics, and for so much more, a memorial to Thomas Paine is needed. For me, working to build this memorial has been a decades-long passion. The life story of Thomas Paine is filled with exciting accomplishments, life and death situations, and written messages of hope, freedom, and democracy. When I moved to Pennsylvania in 1990, I immediately began to visit the areas in which Thomas Paine lived and worked. And I was surprised to find no significant recognition of him, even in the city of Philadelphia, the place where Benjamin Franklin introduced Thomas Paine to his fellow colonists as the fight for independence began. And I'm proud to have helped to place a historical marker at the location where Thomas Paine's pamphlet Common Sense was published. I also began delivering educational programs to elementary schools about this often forgotten founding father. And it was such a joy to conduct the life and work of Thomas Paine assemblies in schools named after Thomas Paine. The Thomas Paine Memorial Association yearns for national recognition of this esteemed patriot in the form of a monument. And we hope to finally and significantly honor the man who fomented the Revolutionary War and who is largely responsible for the very creation of the United States of America. A memorial will inspire more study of his timeless writings and serve the public well as an educational tool. And I'll close with the sincere hope that a Thomas Paine memorial will build bridges of understanding and help the inhabitants of this great country heal prevailing divides as we push forward the promotion of democracy, equality, and justice.
And that was Margaret Downey, who's the president of the Thomas Paine Memorial Association. After the break, we will hear more of the testimony given to the National Capitol Memorial Advisory Committee in favor of a permanent memorial to Thomas Paine in Washington, D.C. And you will hear how the committee voted.
And after that, we'll speak with Philip Gorski about the new book, The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Margaret Sanger's motto was, "No gods, no masters." This is Free Thought Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we are listening to the testimony before the National Capitol Memorial Advisory Committee a few weeks ago, asking for their endorsement for a memorial to Thomas Paine in the capital city of Washington, D.C.
And then Mark Dan introduced a military veteran, Gene Jones, and Mandisa Thomas of Black Nonbelievers.
My name is Gene Jones, and I'm the president of Florida Veterans for Common Sense. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I served 4 years in the Air Force, and I was trained as a linguist and was honorably discharged in 1968. As veterans, we believe that Thomas Paine should have a memorial. In our opinion, he ranks among the greatest of the founding fathers, and many call him the founding father. And we agree. Paine, a fellow veteran who served in the Continental Army as an aide to General Nathaniel Greene, was a thought leader who gave us the idea of America as an independent republic, as Representative Raskin said this morning. There are few veterans in American history who have done so much to save an army and win a war. Many know, of course, that Paine wrote Common Sense, which turned our rebellion into a revolution by the radical idea that America didn't need an English king. He argued that we could govern ourselves independent of England. What many people don't know is that after the defeat at New York, the Continental Army was in full retreat and on the verge of collapse. Morale was so low, the troops were deserting. General Washington, a friend of Paine's, asked him to write something to motivate the troops. Paine sat at a drumhead and by candlelight wrote the Crisis Papers number 1. These are the times that try men's souls. Paine's words were so stirring that General Washington ordered them read to the troops, and morale soared. The army crossed the Delaware, we're all familiar with that, and they won the battles of Trenton and Princeton. And the army, and thus the revolution, was saved. As veterans, we say Paine conceived of the American idea. and he kept it alive at its lowest ebb. Paine should have a memorial that will continue to inspire us all with the promise of America, and that's what he believed in.
My name is Mandisa Thomas, and I am the founder and president of Black Nonbelievers, which is headquartered in the Atlanta, Georgia area. Pursuing justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion is integral to our work. And it is with this in mind that we support the memorial for Thomas Paine and his commitment to humanism and justice, including his anti-slavery advocacy, as Margaret Downey mentioned earlier. A little known fact is that on April 14, 1775, Paine and other Philadelphians formed the Society for Relief of Free Negroes Unlawfully Held in Bondage, which is America's first abolitionist group. Paine, who never owned slaves, wrote a 22-page handwritten letter to Thomas Jefferson that Paine signed from a slave. This letter, in which he admonished Jefferson for personally owning slaves, also argued that slavery was contrary to those ideas that Jefferson himself posed in the Declaration of Independence. My favorite Thomas Paine quote is, "I believe in the equality of man, and I believe that religious duties consist in doing justice, loving mercy, and endeavoring to make our fellow creatures happy." This quote mirrors Paine's activism and life appropriately, given his advocacy for African-American education and his many writings, including an essay penned shortly after Common Sense in February of 1776, in which he stated that African slavery was against the laws of nature and reason. It is important to acknowledge that many institutions and their founders and leaders perpetuated and benefited from systems of oppression. That history cannot be unlived, but facing these difficult truths allow us to do our best work going forward. For many Black people, identifying with the Founding Fathers and the founding of the United States is complicated and complex. To know that freedom for all at that time only meant Anglo-Saxon landowners can be difficult to reconcile. However, this complexity is exactly why Thomas Paine should be memorialized, not only as a pioneering founding father, but also as a pioneering anti-slavery activist who made an indelible mark on America's social and political landscape. Let us honor Paine's legacy through this memorial in Washington, D.C., so that we can remain on the right side of justice.
So that was some of the testimony. There were others such as Charis Horrid, who testified for the youth groups, and Karen Heineman, an FFRF legal fellow. And after hearing this wonderful testimony, I'm so pleased to announce that the National Capital Memorial Advisory Committee endorsed the plan.
Unanimously.
Unanimously. Right? It was representatives from the National Park Service, the Department of Defense, the mayor's office in D.C., and so on. So we were very pleased.
We'll be talking more about that in the future. We're going to take a break, and then we'll come back to speak with Philip Gorski, co-author of the new book, The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at FFRF.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers. Speaking freely, thinking freely. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. Welcome back to the show. Philip S. Gorski is the Frederick and Laura Goff Professor of Sociology and of Religious Studies at Yale. He's the chair of the Sociology Department. He works on the intersection of religion and politics. His work has appeared widely in many publications or has been discussed in The Atlantic, The Guardian, The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, as well as many periodicals and media outlets in Europe. His many books include American Babylon, Christianity and Democracy Before and After Trump, American Covenant, A History of Civil Religion from the Puritans to the Present, and The Protestant Ethic Revisited.
Philip Gorski's newest book, co-authored with Samuel L. Perry, is The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy. And we recently had Samuel Perry on, and we are delighted now to have his co-author, Philip Gorski. Welcome to Free Thought Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we're speaking to you all the way, well, you're all the way from Amsterdam. I guess we're your submarine, so that's very nice you made time for us.
My pleasure to be with you guys.
So, Professor Gorski, what got you interested in researching white Christian nationalism?
It's just sort of a long story, I guess. You know, in some ways, it's a biographical story. I grew up in a town called Wheaton, Illinois, which is, you know, a kind of a major, you know, center of evangelical Protestantism in the United States. Wheaton College is there. The Billy Graham Center is there. And so I've always had a kind of an interest in this subject, and first started looking at it in a very historical way, and then suddenly saw the stuff that I was studying in the past becoming increasingly relevant to the present, and felt an urgent need to kind of send up a warning flare about what I saw happening. And the result of that was this co-authored book with my friend and colleague Sam Perry.
So the subtitle of your book, The Flag and the Cross, is White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy. What is white Christian nationalism?
Well, one way of thinking about it is as a mythological version of American history that goes something like this. America was founded as a Christian nation. The founders were Orthodox Christians. The founding documents are based on Christian principles. America has been chosen by God for a special mission to spread freedom and Christianity around the world and given the power and prosperity necessary to do that. But the increasing presence of non-whites, non-Christians, non-native-born Americans on American soil is threatening that power and prosperity and ultimately that mission. And we call this, in the book, we call it a deep story. And we call it that for a couple of different reasons, because it's deep in various senses. I mean, one is it's just historically deep. This is not something that just sort of, you know, popped up on January 6th or with the moral majority in the early 1980s. It's something that's been around in the U.S. in one version or another for centuries. It's also deep in the sense that it's really deeply rooted in the culture, including in secular popular culture. So you find kind of these Christian nationalist themes of kind of apocalyptic struggles between good and evil, kind of heroic white men, you know, battling against kind of cultural and religious others. I mean, that's something that you find in, you know, movies and fiction that's not explicitly Christian at all. And it's deep also in the sense that I think for a lot of people who are influenced by this ideology, it travels very much under the surface. There are, of course, folks out there. There's kind of a Christian nationalist industrialist complex, of, you know, folks who basically make their living by kind of propagating these ideas. But it's also just part of a of Christian conservative subculture, so that people just pick up these ideas without necessarily even being terribly consciously aware of it. So that's one way to think about it. It's this deep story, this mythological version of American history.
You you mentioned the January 6th insurrection, and in your book you even say that the January 6th insurrection was like the eruption of a volcano. Is that what you're talking about? Is that a symptom, what we saw on January 6th, of white Christian nationalism?
Yeah, you know, the amazing thing about that is that, you know, some folks have said, wow, you know, it was, I guess you decided to write this book after January 6th, because that's how we opened the book up. But that's not all. That's not the case. We were practically done with the manuscript when that happened. And, you know, it just reinforced for us that we were talking about something that was very important and very dangerous. And also, I think, made it possible for us to, you know, immediately show readers that this is something that they really did need to be aware of and pay attention to. But, yeah, I mean, this is another way of thinking about the deepness, right? I mean, there's kind of these deep, slow-moving forces in our politics and our society that, you know, kind of erupted and on that day. And, you know, if you will, the kind of the plume that shot up over the volcano was like all of the flags and the banners and the symbols that you saw being waved over the Capitol. And it looked sort of like, you know, apples and oranges, I think, to folks who hadn't been following this or studying this for 20 years the way that we had. But, you know, for us, seeing, you know, the Christian gallows and the wooden gallows and the Confederate flag and the Jesus Saves banners all kind of right next to each other.
And the Christian flag, yeah.
We were seeing it. Yeah, we knew what we were seeing right away.
The Christian flag that flew on January 6th and now has flown over the City Hall in Boston yesterday. I don't know if you followed that, but anyway.
I did not catch that.
Yeah, well, it was the Supreme Court decision saying that they had to let them do it. Anyway, I'm wondering about whether, I know you've been in Amsterdam, but after your book has come out, we have now seen public officials, candidates, other people embracing the term of Christian nationalism, such as Marjorie Taylor Greene, coming right out and saying the Republican Party should be the party of Christian nationalism. What's your take on that?
Well, I don't think that in Marjorie Taylor Greene's case that there was a lot of deep thought that went into this. Huh. She just said, hey, I'm a Christian, I'm a nationalist, and if the liberals are calling me, say Christian nationalism is a bad thing, then I'm gonna kind of embrace that. But, you know, that's not to say that she isn't a Christian nationalist and quite, you know, quite an extreme version of one. One thing I saw this morning was a clip of Lauren Boebert, her, Marjorie Taylor Greene's erstwhile sidekick, basically saying on some right-wing TV show, I think there should be a sort of a biblical test for citizenship. That people would have to, you know, pass some sort of test about their knowledge of the Bible in order to become American citizens and be admitted to vote. So, you know, those are the really extreme forms of it. And, you know, I think one thing that's really important to realize is that, there is kind of a spectrum. There are more and less extreme versions of it. But, you know, the less extreme versions of it and sympathies for people like Boebert and Greene extend pretty deep into the American population. So this is, you know, this is not something that's fringe. I think that's really a very key point. You know, the fringe is what you see, but, you know, it's like the tip of the iceberg above the water. And underneath the water, there's, you know, a lot more mass than there is showing above the water.
Well, certainly, we started the Freedom from Religion Foundation as a national group in 1978, and the primary myth that we have been fighting in trying to buttress the wall of separation is this myth that the United States was founded as a Christian nation. I mean, this has been something that we've been trying to educate about for decades, but what the crank mail that we have gotten over the years, it now looks like this has gone mainstream. The kind of response, you don't belong in this country if you're not a Christian, or if you're complaining about religion and government, you should go to Iran or, you know, whatever. We're seeing something much more, I think, dangerous developing in our nation. And when we come back from the break, Professor Gorski, we're going to ask you about your views on the future.
We're talking with Professor Philip S. Gorski, who is the co-author with Samuel L. Perry of the book The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy. We'll be right back with more Free Thought Radio after this.
I'm an atheist and former Catholic. I even wrote a play about it called Letting Go of God. Right now, Catholic bishops are using their considerable influence to deny women contraceptive rights. Please join the Freedom From Religion Foundation and help keep church and state separate. You can call 1-800-335-4021, that's 1-800-335-4021, or visit ffrf.org to stand up for true religious freedom.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
Welcome back. I'm Dan Barker, and we're continuing our talk with Professor Philip S. Gorski. He's a co-author with Samuel L. Perry of the book The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy. So Professor Gorski, your book's about white Christian nationalism. Aren't there Hispanic and black churches that are evangelical who also believe America was founded as a Christian nation?
There absolutely are. Though I would draw a pretty sharp distinction between African American evangelicals and Hispanic evangelicals. African American evangelicals are really quite different. So when they think about America being founded as a Christian nation, I mean, they're not hearing Jerry Falwell or Franklin Graham or Donald Trump. They're hearing Martin Luther King and Barack Obama. That is, you know, this would be an America that really lives up to its founding principles of freedom and equality. Whereas, I think when white evangelicals hear this, it's more like, kind of a rallying call to my cultural and religious tribe. And there are increasing numbers of Hispanics who are converting to evangelical Christianity and Pentecostalism, and increasing numbers of them, too, who are being pulled into the GOP, as we know from the most recent elections in places like Texas and Florida, where the results were quite different than some people expected. So I think it is fair to say, though, that for conservative white evangelicals, Christian nationalism does have a kind of a implicit racial coding or meaning when they think about good Christians, they think about people like themselves.
Yeah. I think that's human nature. We tend to want to protect our culture. We spoke with Anthea Butler recently, and she says that even some of the black churches are embracing in principle the idea that the founding of America was a Christian founding, even though they do, as you say, look at it in different ways.
And we should say that the foreword to The Flag and the Cross book is by Jamar Tisby, who talks a little bit about that too. But so the conclusion of your book that you co-wrote with Samuel Perry it's titled Avoiding the Big One, because you have this volcano eruption theme.
In San Andreas Fault.
In the San Andreas Fault. And, what are you thinking is going to be the future of white Christian nationalism and can American democracy survive?
Well, I certainly hope that it does survive. But I am very concerned that it's under a grave threat at the moment, and from various forces, but certainly from white Christian nationalists who, so long as they were in the majority electorally and population-wise, were more or less happy to make a kind of a peace with democracy as long as other groups didn't get color too much outside of the lines in their view. But increasingly, they're facing minority status. And so I think that the danger that we really see now is that they are going to sort of redefine the electorate, take advantage of institutions in a way to cement a long-standing minority rule, which will really make it very difficult for folks on the other side to ever really take back power in the near future. And this isn't just kind of idle speculation. Similar kind of dynamics have been observed in various other countries, including here in Europe and in Hungary and
yeah.
Poland. And it's no accident that that Viktor Orban, the premier of Hungary, is a kind of a rock star hero to a lot of these folks in, you know, promoting his vision of Christian democracy, quote unquote, or a liberal democracy, he sometimes put it in, which is effectively that. He's, packed the judiciary, he's amended the constitution, he's gerrymandered the electorate, and through those mechanisms has managed to stay in power now for over a decade. And that, I think, is the scenario that really worries me, and which folks on the right are actively planning for, right? I mean, they've got the Supreme Court. This Schedule F plan that you may have heard of that Trump has been talking about to completely purge the civil service and pack it with loyalists. The kind of big lie voter suppression stuff that's going on, the efforts to take over the folks who are going to be counting and certifying their votes, the secretaries of state in various swing states.
And we've seen some successes there.
It's very clear what the plan is. It's very clear what the plan is.
Yeah, it's so overt and so audacious. Now, you also mentioned Poland. And, we were there in Poland, I think, 2017, and that's when I started to get alarmed that, what happened in Poland with abortion rights was happening in the United States, and here we are. They have the most draconian abortion laws in Europe and the European Union, and we've seen women die, and now we've seen Roe versus Wade overturned by our packed Supreme Court, and it's just so dismaying. And
that's a Catholic Christian nation idea.
The Solidarity Union brought in Catholicism, and there went freedom. So. Do you have an opinion on court reform?
I think something has to be done. It could be expanding the court. It could be placing term limits on the justices. It might also just be, Congress does have the power to place restrictions on the kinds of cases that the court can and can't decide, and on the jurisdiction of the court. This is very clearly stated in the Constitution. And this is nothing new. This has happened in the past. It's one way of understanding what happened during the New Deal era when the last far-right Supreme Court was in power and was blocking important and necessary political and social reforms in the United States. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt, kind of fired a shot over the bow with the so-called court packing scheme as if this was something new and unusual, which, it wasn't. I mean, this is, again, there have been varying numbers of justices on the court, varying levels of jurisdiction that they've had, and there's no reason, why this shouldn't happen again. I mean, democracy is ruled by the people. It is not ruled by nine unelected judges serving for life.
Is there really the will right now in Congress, or even the ability in Congress with the filibuster, to do anything?
No, clearly, right? I think you would have to get the Democrats would have to hold the Senate and actually not just hold it, but gain a few seats. And have enough people who are committed to overturning the filibuster and pushing through some serious reform. It's close, you know. I mean, almost all but a handful now of the senators have basically pledged themselves to filibuster reform. So if, you know, some of these horrible Trump-backed, Teal-funded candidates actually prove to be too far to the right, even for a suburban Republican, you know, I think it's possible that the Democrats actually will expand their, you know, their the number of seats they have in the Senate. But you know, it's hard to say. We'll have to wait and see how things go this fall.
So back to white Christian nationalism here. I was intrigued by something you said in your book. We have about a minute left here. What do you mean when you say that it's a mistake to characterize white Christian nationalists as conservatives? You say that we should classify them more as reactionary. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, a conservative, the way I understand it, is somebody who wants to conserve institutions and values and traditions, and there certainly are still such conservatives in the United States. But I think the sort of slogan of a lot of kind of Trumpier Republicans these days is burn it all down, you know, drain the swamp, blow up the system, and that's not conservative. I mean, that's radical and reactionary. That's you know, an attempt to sort of destroy rather than conserve.
Wow. Well, let's hope and not pray that there's some better times ahead in the future.
And certainly the flag and the cross is something that you will want to read, and it is available from ffrf.org/shop or wherever you buy your books. The subtitle is White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy. We've been talking with its co-author, Philip S. Gorski. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for sounding the alarm and
Being with us today.
Yes. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
And thank you to listeners to Free Thought Radio in Philadelphia, WOOM, in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, to WZML, in Madison, Wisconsin, to WIDE and WMUU, in Janesville, Wisconsin, to WADR Community Radio, in Bryan, Texas, to KEOS, in San Marcos, Texas, to KZSM, Columbia, Missouri, KEOPN, in Eugene, Oregon, KEPW, in Vermont, New Hampshire, right on the border there, WOOL Black Sheep Radio. I love that name of that, WOOL. In Kingston, Rhode Island, they're connected with the university, WRIU. In Ithaca, New York, in Watkins Glen, New York, WRFI. And also hello to listeners to Global Community Radio at Sundays at 11 p.m. all over the country.
11 p.m. Central? Eastern?
11 p.m., well, that's what they say on their website, 11 p.m., whatever. And also hello to all you podcast listeners. And if you like our show and want to help reach others, give us a thumbs up on your podcast provider and find out more about our show at ffrf.org/radio.
And find out more about the Freedom From Religion Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit that works to keep religion out of government and social policy and to educate the public about the views of non-believers. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.